stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 164 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. From a gray, cloudy, and rainy San Francisco, I'm Andrew Brokus. And joining me from a hopefully somewhat nicer Somerville, Massachusetts is Nate Mavis.
It's gorgeous outside. It is 64 degrees.
What? Or roughly, it's warmer there than it is here.
Like 18 Celsius, I guess. And it's clear and sunny and perfect. And this is a proof that I love our listeners so, so very much, because there's not much that could keep me in my closet right now where I do my podcasting. But for our listeners, I would do that. So, yeah. So let's record a good episode, and then I'm going to run outside and dance and sing and enjoy the first really nice warm day of spring.
Nice. I'm jealous.
Yeah. You should be. It's great.
Speaking of jealousy, I'm starting to second guess my decision not to play Bay 101, which, you know, I kind of said that it's going on right now, not terribly far from where I live, the main event of the World Poker Tour event at Bay 101, the Shooting Star event, which I have played once before. I played it, I think, in like 2008. And I kind of made this conscious decision that I'm trying not to play as many tournaments, and especially like high buy-in tournaments, that it's just I don't know that my hourly is really that much higher than it would be even like in a good, you know, one. I don't know that it's that much higher by the time I, you know, sell a decent amount of myself and whatnot than, you know, just playing cash. And there's a lot of, even to travel, I mean, it's, I would have to rent a car for one thing, and then like it's probably an hour plus drive each way to get there. So it's not like wildly convenient, although it's pretty damn convenient for what's probably a pretty good event. But I don't know. So I kind of like told myself I was going to make this active effort not to, to avoid the temptation of playing these like, you know, big buy-in tournaments. I think, you know, the variance and whatnot, it just doesn't strike me as the best decision for me. But now that I see people, you know, tweeting about it and whatnot, I'm like, oh, am I making a mistake? Should I be playing this right now?
You're having the same problem that everybody who doesn't come to Las Vegas for the World Series has, you know. They feel so smug and self-satisfied. and then all of a sudden I get all these like Twitter messages like, really regretting not coming out. Boy, do I want to be playing the main right now. So the Olympic element, as Dara O'Carney puts it, is turns out to be a very strong and important part of poker.
Yeah, and it's impressive how successful the Twitter what a successful unpaid marketing tool that is for any poker event and kind of for poker in general. But I think maybe they appreciate it and just don't feel like they have to do anything to promote it because it's happening already. But I think it's potentially somewhat underappreciated just how much it helps, you know, events like this to have a bunch of people in the event playing, because, you know, most poker players follow a bunch of other poker players on Twitter, and you just kind of get the strong social signal like, this is where everybody is right now, this is where I should be also. And yep. I think it's a very powerful marketing tool.
Yeah, absolutely. At the Horseshoe, in when I played an event there recently, not the Horseshoe, the other place where the event was in Indiana, they had like a monitor set up with, and if you tweeted with a certain hashtag, a lot of the tweets would be displayed. At some point I had like 20-40% of all those tweets or something. Wow.
Yeah. See, that's cool. That's the kind of thing that I've never seen before. And like I said, maybe there's no need for them to encourage it because it's happening plenty already. But I would think, you know, it might be a good idea for tournament organizers to provide some sort of incentive for players to be tweeting about their event. You know, like maybe give away, even do like a random seat drawing for somebody who, you know, or a cash prize drawing or something if you tweet about the event and hashtag it or something.
Yeah, no, I mean, it would make sense, and it is very Ameristar, by the way, is where I was, and I thought it was a very well-run event, and it was a nice hotel, so hooray for that. But they don't have a poker room usually, so don't run over there and try to play poker because you'll be disappointed. But yeah, no, I mean, it makes a lot of sense, and it's just this very, very powerful tool, and yeah, I think it's a win-win. I think it makes the experience better for players. I think it helps the casino. I think also a lot of people really enjoy following people on Twitter. So, no, it's a good tool. I wouldn't be surprised if fairly modest inducements could reap outsized rewards for the rooms.
And now we've just given away valuable advertising information for free.
It's true.
Fools.
Yeah.
Well, if you enjoy the Thinking Poker podcast, you can always tweet at us at Thinking Poker. Well, I mean, Nate sees those, but technically that's my account, and at Nate Mavis. And we're happy to engage with you all on Twitter. As you can probably guess from our babbling here, we don't have a guest, so you're in for a lot more of this over the course of the next hour or so. But I do think we have some pretty interesting strategy questions, and I mean, we'll probably talk about at least one actual hand, but we do sometimes get some more... vague's not the right word, but just, you know, big picture strategy questions that don't necessarily deal with one individual hand. And I like to try to save those for episodes like these, because I just think it can lead to some interesting discussion. So we've got a couple of neat ones of those coming up today, I think. Before we get onto those, I want to maybe just throw out one more thing, which, you know, we've talked about programming a few times on the show, and I think people probably know that you have some background in that, and I guess I've mentioned that I've been making a little bit of an effort to learn it, and I want to give a shout out in particular to a Coursera course that I'm doing, which is, I think it's just called Principles of Computing, or that's like the name of the specialization. I don't actually recommend signing up for this, like paying for the specialization. So, I mean, the way Coursera works is you can take the classes for free, and if you want to get some kind of like certificate saying that you actually completed the class, you have to pay money for that. It's hard for me to imagine that certificate really carrying too much weight with anybody anywhere. Maybe it does. I mean, maybe you have a specific reason for doing it, but for the most part, I don't really... I don't have any reason why I would be, you know, paying to get the certificate, but I do find it interesting to go through the class. I feel like I've learned a decent amount from, and it's pretty well set up. And I've had mixed experiences with these online, you know, classes. There's a fair number that I haven't completed just because they seemed kind of like frivolous or poorly taught or whatever, and it's kind of thrown together. And this particular one, which is out of Rice University, I would say is quite good. I mean, I guess I don't really have the expertise to say that they're covering the important stuff, but it feels like they're covering a lot of kind of important fundamental stuff and doing it in a rigorous way, and they're informative, and the instructors are, I mean, they're very geeky, but, you know, what do you expect from a computer science class? They're likable, and I'm enjoying it a lot. So I would encourage people who are interested in, like, this is about Python specifically, although I think a lot of the concepts are relevant to other languages as well, but this is Principles of Computing, I think it's called, on Coursera.
Fantastic. If you want to read blog posts where I review various online tools for learning about computers, you can do that. I can try to dig them up and put them in the show notes. I think that there's a lot of great stuff out there. I learned largely from online courses. Of course, in my case, I was building on top of a very much not free and very much you know, like, very restricted access education and math before then, but yeah, I think there's a lot of great stuff out there, and I've written a lot about which MOOCs to take and not to take, and which ones are best if your goals are a certain way. I'm glad that the new Coursera stuff is also good.
Yeah, and you know, I didn't really, my interest here is not so that I can like learn how to create a poker AI or something. I mean, I think the people who are already doing that are way better at it than I'm ever going to get to be. And I'm not even making the use of the, you know, commercially available tools that exist now. I'm not at a point where I have a need to create my own like hyper specialized tool. So, I mean, that's not the reason that I'm taking this class. But one of the things that's interesting about this specialization is it focuses on interactive, on using programming to create interactive games in Python. Yeah. And the first course that I took really was about, like, I mean, creating actual, like, just little, like, video game things that you play. But this current one, the Principles of Computing, is So like the activity that I'm working on right now is creating a tic-tac-toe AI, which is actually something we already did earlier in the class using Monte Carlo methods, which is kind of the same thing that one of the things that a tool like PokerStove does, where it just kind of runs out a bunch of simulations and then gets an approximation of your equity. It just looks at two hands and a flop and it runs like, you know, a million or whatever simulations of how that board could run out, and looks at how often each player wins those, and then uses that to give you an idea of what your equity looks like in that spot. So we've already like looked at tic-tac-toe using that same method and learning how to run those simulations, and then how to learn from them essentially. And we're now applying a mini-max technique to do the same thing, which is it felt very familiar to me from like the game theory study that I've done in poker. You know, the idea is to sort of look at how can I minimize at every decision point, how can I minimize the potential damage my opponent could do to me? So it's sort of another way of solving that game. But I think that, you know, in addition to it being a good class, I think it's something that might be of interest to people who are interested in like games and game theory and poker in general, because somewhat unintentionally that has come up as well.
Absolutely.
Anyway, I promised some interesting hands, or some interesting strategy discussions, not necessarily hands. Nate, you wanna read this first one?
Sure. The first one comes from Sky. Sky says, "I play in a weekly family dealer's choice home game. It's always a good time, but we play some wacky community card games like Heaven and Hell, Follow the Queen, and many others that we just made up. I'm trying to improve my poker game, but playing these crazy games really doesn't seem to add to my skill set. When it's my choice, I'll often play a full round of Stud 8 or better or Omaha 8 with a kill, and that's when my skill comes into play. How can I use this situation to further my poker skills? How can I learn from these crazy community card games that everybody else really favors, but where the strategy doesn't apply to my standard games?"
I think that, well, first off, I think it's an interesting question, and I think that it's something that a lot of people worry about. Whether it's, I don't know if it's exactly his situation for some people, that they're playing games that aren't even spread in casinos, but a lot of people will tell me, you know, the only game I can afford to play right now is 1-2, or I'm just playing, you know, 10-cent, 20-cent games online, and everybody here is bad. How am I ever going to get better at poker playing against these bad players? And I really kind of resist that argument, because, and I think it kind of rests on a, maybe misunderstanding isn't the right way to say it, because it's not like one of us is right and one of us is wrong, but like not necessarily using strategy in the same sense, that we don't mean the same thing when we say strategy. So if you're thinking of strategy as knowing a set of hands that you should open from each position at the table at no limit hold'em, or knowing that top pair with a good kicker is a pretty good hand at no limit hold'em when you have a stack to pot ratio of 3 or less, or, you know, stuff like that. Yeah, you're not going to learn that from playing Follow the Queen. But I would say that that's not really the most important part of poker strategy. Like trying to memorize solutions to situations that come up is not really the best way of studying the game past a beginner level, because a lot of situations are going to come up that are not memorizable, and there's going to be variation and whatnot. And the more important thing is to underline or to understand what I would consider the kind of underlying strategy behind any sort of poker, which is, or really behind any game. You know, this is why we call it game theory. It's a theory of games. Both players are trying to do well. And I think that as long as you're playing with people who are trying to do well, even if they're not very good at it, they're not playing completely randomly. So when you play in a really small stakes game, or you play in a home game where people are just sort of splashing around and gambling, those people are, I mean, in most cases, they're still not literally playing every hand that they're dealt. And they're not literally stacking off every, you know, just going all in every single time. I mean, occasionally that happens, and that's a nice game to be in. But for the most part, your opponents are trying to play well. And they understand what their incentives are in the game, more or less. They know that they're trying to make a strong hand and or bluff you out. And that they're not, that, you know, they're trying to avoid putting a lot of money in when they have bad hands. So they know what their incentives are, and they're trying to play well. And your job is to, you know, try to play well, given that they are also trying to play well. To, you know, try to predict what they're doing and try to put them in situations where it's difficult for them to play well. And in poker, you know, we know that requires some amount of bluffing, and we know that it requires some amount of you know, building the pot when you have strong hands, and it requires bluff catching, and it requires folding. And those are all elements of any of these poker games, with the exception of some of the really crazy ones that aren't even really poker games, like, you know, people might play Guts or something like that, where there's no actual betting involved, and that's kind of a different... I would say those aren't really poker games anymore. But if you're just talking about wild card games and follow the queen and that sort of thing, I mean, bluffing and value betting are still elements of those games. And what constitutes a strong hand or a good bluffing hand will change. But the fundamental skill of recognizing when you have a good bluffing hand or when you have a good a hand that's strong enough to better raise for value, when your opponent has a lot of incentive to bluff, and when you have a good bluff catcher, those things are relevant in all of those games. And I actually think that you know, I don't know, I can't promise you that being the world's best follow the queen player will enable you to, you know, play good hold'em if you've never played hold'em before, but I do think that playing some games that are different from your main game can actually be a good way of expanding your mind a little bit and actually improving the way you play your main game.
Yeah, I completely agree. I also have a not a hustler's perspective, but I have a different perspective on some of this. I think the standard correct answer to this question, or one standard correct answer, is to, you know, think about everybody's ranges, think about playing properly, think about good value betting, think about bluffing, and so on. And that's exactly right. Another kind of answer is that you never know what's going to be popular, and super stud and things like that. You know, a lot of money is bet every day in super stud games, or at least it was the last time I checked. And that's a game that would have looked like a wacky home game very recently. And I think that that trend is going to continue. I think that in a lot of, especially mid to higher stakes games, people have more or less given up on finding a lot of random fish who are going to play the game, and they would rather try to get small edges over each other. And if that means playing exotic games that'll make it impossible for a really big mark to show up, that's a cost that, you know, these communities are willing to pay now. So I think we are going to see more and more wacky games in the mid to high stakes mixes in Las Vegas and in places like that. However, I have something else to say, which is that there's an element of truth to some of these complaints, such as the one that Sky has. In college, I used to play a game called Low in the Hole Stud, where half the pot went to the lowest spade, I think, in the hole. It was 7-card stud.
Yeah, I've played that before.
Yeah, and that's a game that shares something with some of these other basement games, which is that it's pretty easy to make the nuts, or to make the nuts one way. And that can really sort of simplify the strategy, or force you into a whole lot of folding, or a whole lot of just calling down if your odds are good, if you're getting the right price. And that's fine. Those situations come up in hold'em too, where, you know, one player's range is capped or whatever. But it's not always that exciting. And I think there's maybe something to the idea that those games can be strategically a little bit more impoverished, at least in some cases. And my sort of hustler suggestion is that for everybody's fun and benefit, and also for your development as a player, instead of choosing Omaha 8 or better, which a lot of basement players are likely to hate, why don't you choose a game that is wacky but also has the nuts problem a little bit less? So games with wild cards can be like this. Super stud can be like this. I'm sure, you know, I mean, any number of basement games, possibly Follow the Queen. I can't quite remember all the details of that one, but a lot of basement games have plenty of strategy and don't have that really easy to make the nuts problem. And I would suggest that for everybody's fun and for your development as a player, you call those instead of casino games. And those are more likely to catch on, and people are more likely to replace games like Low in the Hole Stud with those games, and everybody wins.
I'm a little surprised to hear you say that you don't think the wildcard games fall into this easy to make the nuts problem, because I actually kind of feel like wildcard games tend to be, I mean, There are certain games that are, if they're well designed to not have very many wild cards and don't let the wild cards have a huge impact on the strategy, it can work out okay. I mean, even like 8 or better games are a little bit like that, and like, and, you know, an ace can play high or low, and so having an ace in your hand, you know, aces are like much, much, much better cards than any other cards in those games. But I think that games that have a lot of wild cards do essentially have that nuts problem where it's just like getting dealt 2 wild cards in baseball is sort of like you practically do have the nuts.
Yeah. I mean, you do, but I think it's a little bit harder than just catching the deuce of spades in the hole. And, you know, the other person can have wild cards, but you can have wild cards too. If you'd like a good game, I'm aware of a game called Silver Spring Draw. It's of a friend's and my invention, and I'm happy to. It's much better balanced. I'm happy to post the rules for anybody.
Are they that complicated that you can't just tell us the rules?
It's 7 card draw, high low, pot limit before the draw, and depending on the situation, some cards get exposed. So yeah, 7 card draw high low is the basics of it. Pot limit before the draw, no limit after.
Thank you, Sky, for writing in. You're not going to find strategy information specific to Follow the Queen or other wild card games at Tournament Poker Edge. What you will find is information about how to play poker of any kind better. Information about how to recognize a strong hand or a good bluffing hand when you have one, how to recognize spots where your opponent does or does not have incentive to call you down light, all that stuff that's at the essence of poker, no matter what game you're playing. I've got entire series on the site dedicated to core theoretical skills like range reading, value betting, bluffing, and range construction. Plus, you'll find plenty of hand history reviews and other examples that demonstrate how to apply this theoretical information in the context of actual poker hands. To access all of that and much more, sign up at tournamentpokeredge.com.
And by the time you hear this, you'll only be, I mean, if all goes according to plan, you'll only be a couple weeks away, or maybe 1 week away from my videos being on the site.
Oh, so exciting. We should have had you do that. You'll have to do next week's ad.
Yeah. But I've submitted my first video series. From what I understand, it has not been rejected as horrible. So
shocking.
It's up to the listeners to, or the viewers to, reject it as horrible if they would like to. Yeah, so that's all very exciting, I think. It's exciting for me.
It's exciting
for me. My first ever public strategy videos for a site, and not, yeah, so it's very good.
And what's the what's the subject matter of these videos?
It is going hand by hand through the 2015 main event day one. So there'll be 5
episodes. Not the same one that your book covers, right?
That's right.
The book 2015. 2014, right?
That's right. This is 2015. These are fresh hands, except for one that I wrote an article about for Poker News. all but one of the hands has never been before discussed publicly, except briefly on Twitter, maybe. Yeah, and I go through it hand by hand. It's a lot like the book, except you don't get Andrew, Gareth, and Leo, but you do get more analysis from me, and you get to go through them. Yeah, you get to go through my main event day one hand by hand, and it's fun. You get to see me develop reads against players, revise those reads, all sorts of pots. I make some big mistakes. I make some nice plays. I guess that's one thing to point out. Some people don't like to pay for advice unless it's from a good player playing well all the time. If that is your attitude, go watch Andrew's videos or go watch somebody else's.
I think this is a big deal, not only because it's you, but people are often asking for, you know, more. Like, there's a lot of people who mostly play live poker who, you know, listen to the show and you know, maybe are members of TPE or have thought about becoming members of TPE, but haven't because they worry it's mostly online content. And I mean, that's one thing that irks me a little bit, similar to what we were just talking about with regard to the, you know, how am I supposed to learn how to play poker from, you know, 1-2 players? Like, it's not that different. Like, watching people play online poker is, you can still learn plenty about how to play live poker. But, you know, people are often, you know, are always asking for, can we get more live poker content? So the fact that these are hands coming from a live poker environment, I imagine, will be exciting for some people as well.
Yeah, I think so. It's fun. And it's I'm also sort of amused at my sort of live pro position in the poker world these days. Like, it's like crusty live pro Nate Mavis is going to be producing some content, et cetera, et cetera. So.
Yeah, I remember how much I used to say. I was like, I'll never become a live grinder. And I guess I'm not really a grinder. I play like 10 to 15 hours a week, but.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Times change.
Our next question is coming to us from Artie. Artie says, good morning, Andrew, Nate, and possibly Carlos. Sorry, no Carlos. I greatly enjoy listening to the podcast while working outside doing environmental surveying in the forest. Like many of the U.S. followers, my opportunities to actually sit down at a table are fairly limited. Well, you might be jealous of my opportunity to sit down at the table, but I'm somewhat jealous of your ability to work out in the forest, so it's all good. Artie says, I was playing recently at a casino, and one of the other players extended the offer to join in a home game in my neighborhood in my hometown. My question involves modifying my cash play from online or casino to suit playing in a home game. Specifically, my goals if I play in the game are to get invited back and enjoy playing poker with my peers. Normally when I play live, I'm willing to 3-bet light in position, check raise with air on flops and turns, float, go for thin value on rivers, and make plays specifically based on opponents' tendencies. More specifically, at casinos, I do try to put people in uncomfortable situations, tilt my opponents, and maximize my return on investment while playing. While I'm friendly and engaging at the casino, I don't exactly endear myself to my opponents with my play. I would be interested in your thoughts about how to adjust play in a more friendly game where possible, I will have an edge on my where it's possible that I will have an edge on my opponents. Furthermore, what is a reasonable amount to take out of a 2-5 or 5-10 home game without endangering my chances of being asked back?
I got some thoughts. You want to go first or should I go first?
You go first.
Yeah, so I think that your chances of getting asked back. So first, there are some regional differences here, but in a lot of places, it'll have a lot more to do with your demeanor and your attitude than it will with your strategy. So if you take 10 seconds and zip up your hoodie, then 3-bet, that's going to be different from just throwing a 3-bet into the pot light. I think there are maybe some home games out there where re-raising without a hand or, you know, checking and raising, if you can imagine such a thing.
I've seen men shot for less.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. If you don't get the reference, you should read Andrew's articles more often. Yeah, so I think all those things are fine. Value betting thin, I think that's fine. This is all great. I think that playing a little bit, if there's one strategic thing that you don't want to do in some of these games, it's playing too tight before the flop. If you have a close decision between opening and folding or calling and folding, maybe you can swing some of those to calls or to raises if you really want. I wouldn't take that overboard, but in some cases where you're expected to play with invisible antes, then that's what you have to do. But for the most part, being a friendly player, not holding up the game, and for heaven's sake, if you lose, treat it as a stroke of luck and don't complain about it. Just, you know, thank everybody for the good time and leave. So that's what I think. In a lot of it's a read based thing in some places, but for the most part, it has a lot more to do with things that are not the strategy you choose. If you have to make strategic adjustments, straddling, if everybody else is straddling, I would suggest straddling. You can just treat it as a blind, but just sort of one where, you know, it's more like the rock or something in games with rocks where you're free to pick up the rock. You're free to put that in your pocket, but then you have to leave and not come back. And it's kind of like that. Yeah, if there's a sports game on TV, don't be stingy about betting $50 on the next shot or whatever. But other than that, I think you're okay. I wouldn't worry too much about a maximum win. If everybody's terrible and you're winning 10 buy-ins, then maybe it's time to pay for the pizza and pick up. But for the most part, I think people attribute a lot to variance. if you're better than they are, they'll probably think you're a fish on the heater. And if they like playing with you, they won't mind losing. So that's what I think. What do you think, Andrew?
I think you said most of it. I mean, of the things that Artie mentions, I think that, you know, some of them, like, you know, being willing to, you know, make plays with without hands or with weak hands and stuff like that. I mean, I think that can even potentially be popular. I imagine it will vary a lot. And I don't have a lot of home game experience myself, but, you know, different recreational players have different interests. You know, some people are really interested in the strategy of the game, and, you know, they really want to, like, focus on playing well and, like, maybe even talk strategy. Like, that's the thing that they enjoy most about the game, is trying to, like, figure it out and understand it better. And, you know, this might be one of those games. Or maybe it's a game where people just really enjoy gambling and they want to, you know, splash around and see who makes the best hand, and that's the thing that they really care about. And maybe it's a game where people just don't, you know, the money isn't that significant to them, and they just want a chance to hang out with friends and drink beers. So, I mean, I think some of it is just going to be figuring out what sort of game is this, who are the people, and different people might have different interests, and, you know, probably some people's opinion of you will matter more than others, I would think. Like, whoever's hosting the game is probably the most important person to sort of pay attention to. You know, what is that person looking for in a player? We actually talked with Carlos about this a little bit on, I guess it was on the premium podcasts that we did with him, so maybe a lot of people haven't heard this, but you know, in his case, it was a somewhat professional home game where it was, somebody was actually making money from running this game. And so Carlos was valuable to that person. Like, the person didn't much care whether the Carlos won or lost. I mean, I guess as long as he wasn't making it miserable for the other players. But, you know, Carlos was valuable to him because he showed up consistently. And so he was essentially serving as a prop, or making sure that there was a game that other people could play in. And that might be the case here. I mean, especially if they're extending invitations to people in a casino, it might be the case that they really need more players from the game. So you may not be in that much danger of getting kicked out as long as you're not, you know, really actively offensive. And again, you know, like Nate said, I don't think the adjustments to how you play are as important as sort of social things that you do. You know, maybe you bring some beers to share the first time you show up, or, you know, stuff like that. And I think, like, especially once you get established as a player in the game, like, you show up a few times, I would think that the threshold for, you know, not inviting you back would get considerably higher. So, you know, maybe you want to be careful about not crushing the game the first time you play. And that's not to say you have to deliberately, you know, take a dive or anything, but you might well, I don't know. You know, I was starting to say you might quit if you're up a little bit, but, you know, that can, I guess that can be perceived badly too, if you just, like, you know, win a couple of buy-ins off of people and then leave well before anyone else is ready to quit. So yeah, I guess there's not really a whole lot you can do about that. I guess be more willing to gamble when you're up, be more willing to do stuff like pay for the pizza when you're up, as Nate mentioned. And pay attention to what it is that is motivating these players. The biggest thing I would say is, I would not deliberately try to tilt people. That's the one thing that Artie mentions in the email that I think is probably not a good idea.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, like that. I mean, just don't be an asshole, basically. Like, in a casino, there may not be much downside to that, because they don't have the power to, like, kick you out, and the player pool is big enough that, you know, you don't care if one individual person has a bad experience. But at a home game, I think that would be a bad idea, and would probably make other people besides just the person that you're needling upset with you. Other than that, I don't think anything that you mentioned here would be that big of a problem.
I agree.
One other thing that's worth pointing out, and I mean, this all sounds on the up and up, there is reason to be a little suspicious when somebody invites you to a home game and you're at if you're at a casino and somebody's like, hey, you know, we all have a game that we play in somewhere else, and, you know, why don't you come back and play with us? I think there's some cause to be a little suspicious there. It sounds like in this case, you know, this was someone who lived in this person's neighborhood, and probably they were talking and found out they live in the same neighborhood, and they're just like, oh, hey, you enjoy this game too. Why don't you come by my house sometime? We play. And, you know, that all sounds fine. And I imagine Artie got a good vibe off this person and trusted his instincts and whatnot. But, especially when there's a lot of money involved, you should be a little suspicious, about, you know, someone's motivations for inviting you to a game and whether or not that game is on the up and up, and all that sort of stuff.
I agree.
Thanks for writing, Artie. Anything else you want to add, Nate?
No, that'll do it. I mean, we've talked about security in other shows, so I'll leave it at that. But I agree, that's a good warning.
Oh, yeah, there was one other thing from the Carless discussion that I meant to add. So I remember him saying at the end of the night in those games, everybody would put up, I don't know, I think it was like $20 or something, and they would just, you know, deal out a board, and whoever had the high hand on that board would win. And Carless didn't like participating in that because he was like, well, it's just gambling and it's stupid. But, you know, there was no rake taken out. And I think what we both told him was, you know, it's really not optional for you to participate.
Yeah, no, you have to do that. That's not optional,
and it's not costing you anything, right? If it's unraked, it's variance, but it's free variance, yeah. And it's just showing that you're willing to give other people a good time, even if there's nothing directly in it for you. You know, like, I don't think anyone was confused about the fact that Carlos was there to make money, and he, especially at that time, was not the most action oriented player. I don't know. I mean, I always consider him like fun to hang out with, but I know that he's not really like that at the poker table. He's very sort of quiet at the poker table. So I can imagine that it was probably pretty important for Carlos to, you know, demonstrate a willingness to give a little something to these players without getting something in return.
Yeah, I think that's right. I once made the mistake of trying to chat with Carlos during a that didn't last long.
Our strategy hand, an actual hand, is coming to us from a player who identified himself as CLA, C-L-A. He said, I found myself kind of lost in a spot where I probably shouldn't have continuation bet in a 3-bet pot. My opponent just recently sat down, so I don't have any specific reads, but it's only 20 cent no limit on a very soft site, so the villain is probably not the best. This is a three-handed...
20 cent big blind.
Yeah, 20 cent big blind, yes. This is a three-handed online game. Our hero is in the small blind with $34.73, but the effective stack is the buttons, which is just over $20. So we're looking at about 100 big blinds here. The hero is dealt ace-queen offsuit in the small blind. The button opens for a minimum raise to 40 cents. The hero 3-bets to $1.60 from the small blind. Seems pretty straightforward so far. I can't really see a case for anything other than 3-betting.
That's right. I can see a case for 3-betting a little bit smaller, but yeah, that's fine. Not too much smaller.
Yeah, I mean, I think given that it's a minimum raise and that it's probably a game where people are going to err on the side of being too loose preflop, I like it.
I mean, yeah, I like it too, but I think it's the most controversial part of this is the sizing.
I agree with that. If you force me to do something differently, I guess I would choose a smaller size, but I'm happy with this size.
Yep, agreed.
And the button calls. So we go to the flop with $3.40 in the pot. The flop is Jack of Hearts, 8 of Diamonds, 5 of Hearts. The hero is holding the Ace of Diamonds and the Queen of Hearts. So Jack 8-5 with 2 hearts. Our hero has Ace Queen with the Queen of Hearts. $3.40 in the pot. I guess Claw insinuated that he thought it was a mistake to continuation bet here. Do you agree with that?
I think it's a tough sort of in-between spot. I think that ace-queen is one of the worst hands on this board that you're going to have after you 3-bet. I guess you'll have king-queen sometimes. You might have a hand like king-10 sometimes, although it's arguable whether you would 3-bet that all the time. The jack and the flush draw and the presence of straight draws, that makes it... that puts ace queen in a significantly worse position against his range. So so the question is what to do given that. This is a hand that I often put in a checking range, I think. I would rather bet like king high hands and some pure air balls than more value hands. And then in my check calling range, I like to have some very strong hands, some medium strength hands, some very strong hands and some hands I'm going to fold, but also some hands that I'm going to call with, you know, just for value and because they have some equity, et cetera, et cetera. So I would often put ace queen offsuit into a check calling range. Against some of these low stakes players, I would just put it in a check folding range. So yeah, I think I would often default to not betting this here. Would you agree with that?
I mostly agree that it's tricky. And a big part of the reason why it's tricky is that ace queen figures to have a lot of equity here, I think. But it's difficult to realize that equity. And part of my concern, I guess the weaker that your opponent is, the more of a case there is for checking. And one of the reasons for that is just that even if you don't have a specific read on your opponent still might do something that makes you, that gives you a lot of information about what his hand is. So if you check and he pots it, I think you can pretty comfortably fold. If you check and he bets 20 cents, you can pretty comfortably call. If you check and he checks behind, you can feel relatively good about your hand. I think there's a decent chance that a lot of people like won't recognize this as, you know, being as good of a spot to bet when you check to them as it is. So I think like a lot of playing against the weaker player, a lot of things can go well when you check. Part of my concern about check calling against a truly unknown player if we're not as comfortable making the assumption that he's going to make some sort of mistake, or that there's a good chance he's going to make some sort of mistake if we check. Part of my concern about checking is that I think it really opens you up to get blown off of a lot of equity, because I think a lot of cards that your opponent is likely to barrel are cards that are good but not great for you. So they're cards where like you'd like to see it on the river card, but you can't necessarily justify calling a bet. So like a third heart comes to mind, a king, a 10, a 9, all these cards that give you a draw of some sort, not to mention the chance that like your ace high is still good, or that your ace and your queen plus your draw are all, you know, potential winners for you. You're gonna have a lot of equity in spots where it's difficult to realize that equity when you're just checking and calling. I can see a case for making what I kind of think of as like an equity realization bet, where it's like, if I'm going to put a dollar 80 into the pot anyway, maybe I'm better off doing it by betting than by checking. Even though, I mean, that's often not the case when you have this sort of hand where, you know, your opponent's not really going to fold better or call with worse, then often it is better to check and call with those. But because I think this, I can just kind of envision a lot of spots where this hand doesn't play that great as a check and call. Essentially just turning the hand into a bluff and saying, you know, there are a lot of good turn cards for me to barrel, even though it's not really a great one street bluffing hand. It might be a pretty good barreling hand. And I can actually imagine some better hands folding. If your villain has like sevens or sixes, I think there's a good chance he'll fold the flop. And if he doesn't, you know, you're going to have a lot of equity against that hand, and also some good barreling opportunities against that hand. And I think that your range is sufficiently strong here. You know, you've got all the overpairs, you've got jacks, you probably have eights. So you have a lot of very strong hands here. And I think that you can just kind of lump ace queen in with those and bet. And even though a lot of the hands your opponent is going to fold are hands like king 10, I don't know that you really benefit that much by letting your opponent check with king 10, or even by letting him bet with king 10. I can see a case for betting, because in part because I don't think you're going to get raised very often on this flop. That would be my biggest concern, is if I were worried about getting raised here, then I really wouldn't want to bet. But I think because of how strong your range is, it's pretty tough for your opponent to raise you. I think this is a board where you should get called a lot more often than you get raised.
Yeah. Well, is that right? I mean, your opponent should have eights and fives a lot more than you do, and might not probably should four bet with jacks a lot. But
I think I would play it the same way pre-flop. I think that's a good enough hand to 3-bet against the button min raise.
Yeah. Okay.
The fives.
9-10. Fives, 9-10. I guess the overpairs. Yeah, I guess that's right. Probably the color has more nut flush draws. More 8x of hearts. Probably. Yeah. Yeah. I think you get raised sometimes here.
Although you do block some of those hands that you were.
That's true. Yeah, okay. I like the bet.
I mean, I think I actually like check calling better without the heart, which is kind of weird, but just because I'm going to feel more comfortable slotting it into it. Like, I guess my concern with check calling is that I don't really know what to do facing a bet on a lot of turn cards, which if I didn't have the heart, it would just be a pretty straightforward, like, check call flop, check fold most turns. And I don't feel as comfortable doing that when I have the heart in my hand.
I agree.
But yeah, it's a tricky spot on the flop.
Yeah.
The hero chooses to bet $1.80, which I think is fine. If I were to bet, I think half pot is a good size to use here, because if we're betting this hand, we're betting a pretty depolarized range, which I think may be correct on this texture. So I think that this is a good size to use, and I think it, as we've discussed, somewhat close between betting and checking, but I certainly don't mind betting half pot. So the hero bets half pot, and the button calls. I think that we can't assume too much from the button's call in terms of information we didn't already have. It's not a guarantee that he would raise here with sets, although many people are, if anything, excessively concerned about protecting their strong hands. And so he might look and say, oh, flush draw on the board, have to raise my set. But I certainly wouldn't be shocked to see somebody slow playing a set. Likewise with like nut flush draws, 8x of hearts. I mean, plenty of people will raise those hands. Some people will call with them. I don't know that, one of those options is obviously much better than the other anyway. So I don't think that we can rule out too much based on the fact that this player didn't raise. I mean, the fact that he called tells us he doesn't have king ten of spades, but I don't know that he's giving us a lot of information by calling as opposed to raising. The turn brings the ten of spades. There is $7 in the pot. The board is jack 10 8 5 with two hearts, hero holds ace queen with the queen of hearts. So now this is one of those cards where we turn to decent draw. We've got double gutter now. I guess I want to bet. I mean, this is essentially following through on my plan from the flop, where I was like, I'm going to treat this as a good barreling / bluffing hand, and I think I want to keep betting now that this is the turn card. Do you see a reason not to do that?
No, I don't. I think you got to be prepared to empty the clip. I think yeah. Some hands that call the flop are going to call again on the turn. I also think that some of his like two pair will just raise now. Like they'll just think, it's all in our fold now, and we'll do that. So I think if you get called, you get called by a lot of one pair hands, and I think you gotta, I think you gotta. Load up. Yeah. Anyway, sorry. I just read your article about sort of macho metaphors. But I think you got to empty
the load up here. And empty the clip.
Yeah. No, I think you got to be ready to put more chips than this in the center of the table if you bet here. You didn't just get called.
Yeah, it actually is pretty similar to what I said on the flop about even it's not really a great one-street bluffing hand, but I kind of want to bet anyway because it's a good multi-street bluffing hand. I think the same thing applies on the turn. I mean, we have a lot of equity here, including sometimes the best hand, although less often on this. I mean, this turn card with like 10-9 improving to a pair and queen-10 improving to a pair. But still, we do have the best hand sometimes here. And we have a lot of equity even against, a hand like 10-9. We have pretty good equity against. Certainly a hand like 8-7, we have good equity against. Plus it might fold. I can imagine some second best hands are just going to fold immediately, but I think there's a lot of hands in the villain's range that will call now because they turned a draw of some sort. So it could be 10-9, 8-9, jack-9, queen-jack, but may well fold the river unimproved. So I think that we're betting on the turn because we're going to have to call a bet anyway, and he might sometimes fold, and we want to, mostly because we want to be able to fire the third barrel on the river. The river brings, and in terms of sizing on the turn, I'd be inclined, so the hero bet $380 into $7, or slightly over half pot. I think I'd be inclined to bet bigger now. On the flop, I was saying that we're kind of betting a depolarized range. I think on the turn, that's a little bit less true. I can imagine a lot of hands that I would check call on the turn. A lot of my pair plus draw hands, I'd be check calling on the turn. It's like the 10-9, 9-8 sort of stuff. 10x of hearts, 8x of hearts. I think those are hands I'd mostly be playing as check calls on the turn. So when I do bet the turn, I'm either going to have a draw without a lot of showdown value like this one, or I'm going to have a pretty strong made hand where for the most part I'll be happy about getting raised. So I think a larger sizing is appropriate on the turn. And I also think that because of a lot of the hands in the opponent's range are hands that are not going to be... Like, if we want to give the opponent any kind of decision, we can't give him a very good price, because I think so many of his hands are going to be pair plus draw kinds of hands that it's just, like, trivial for him to call those for half pot. And when we have a strong hand, we want to be putting more money in the pot against those, and we have a weak hand, we want to be putting more pressure on those. And both of those things, I think, argue for a larger turn bet here. I think I'd want to probably do more like 550.
Yeah, I agree. I think it increases the chances that a bluff works when we want it to work, and it also makes it better when it does work, because we get more money in the pot on the turn. When we hit something, then we have a bigger pot to play with a good hand. It helps.
And when we miss, then, you know, we get to make a bigger bluff on the river and put more pressure. You know, this enables us to access stacks on the river, making a larger bet now, which I think is desirable.
Yeah. Other things equal, a bigger pot can help. Well, that's only sometimes true. Yeah. I think this is a case where inflating the pot with an uncapped range, it helps you out. So it gives you a lot of options.
The river is interesting. So the hero bets 380 and is called by the button. The river is the nine of clubs. So the board now, jack 10, 9, 8, 5. The heart draw did not get there. Our hero is holding ace queen with the queen of hearts. So it has river to straight. 1460 in the pot, 1352 in the effective stacks. I guess I the options I'd be choosing between would be bet small, shove, or I actually wouldn't entirely rule out checking and calling.
I agree. I think on the checking point, I think there should be plenty of queens in your opponent's range, and maybe there won't be that many in your range. In particular, pocket queens and king queen are likely to play different somewhere, and queen jack if you three bet that hand sometimes. So I think and especially sevens, I think your opponent's got a lot more sevens than you do, so I would be tempted to check the nuts here sometimes. I also think you can get a hand like jack 10 to value bet sometimes, maybe exactly jack 10. That's a little sketchier, I think. Against this opponent here, I think I would bet just because there's you see people like check sevens and things like that in these games, and that's pretty horrible for you if it goes check and the other guy has 8-7 or whatever. And against 8-9, you're probably better off betting, even though you're not guaranteed to get called by that hand. So I would bet, but I think checking is well worth considering, especially against a stronger opponent.
Yeah, I mean, I think good default assumptions, and our correspondent here has correctly recognized that although he doesn't have specific reads on this player, you know, let's keep in mind it's a 10-cent, 20-cent game. I think a good default assumption is that most players in these games are going to be too loose and too passive. And the way you take advantage of that is by doing your own value betting, and doing a lot of it and doing it thinly, and not trying to do a lot of like inducing bluffs, or especially not trying to induce thin value bets, which if we check here, some people who only play in small stakes games might just be surprised that we're even talking about checking because they're so accustomed to this idea of like, don't count on your opponent doing the betting for you. But I think that, you know, what we'd be counting on if we checked here is our opponent thinking that we don't have a lot of queens in our range, which is true, and that when we do bet, we almost always have a queen, which means he doesn't have a lot of incentive to pay us off with worse, which, you know, a weak player isn't that likely to recognize, and we're just going to have a lot of hands that don't have queens in them that are going to be in a tough decision if they bet the river, which means that they can probably do some more, like, as you mentioned, Nate, some thin value betting with, you know, lower straights, maybe even sets or two pair. But I mean, Seth's probably raised before now, but, you know, two pair or something potentially could even try to value bet the river. So I think that, you know, better, more aggressive players, there's more of a case for checking here because of how much of our range we're going to need to check. Like, they have a lot of incentive to bet worse hands. But I think weaker players tend not to recognize that sort of thing and just are happy to see showdown and take them, and also might be getting here with a weaker range than we realize, or willing to call a bet on the river with a weaker range than we would expect. So I think that betting, you know, a small amount, I think shoving would be a mistake. I think shoving looks very strong, and it's going to be hard for the villain. And the villain can have a lot of queens in his range as well. So, I mean, the villain really does not have that much incentive to call a river shove with a worse hand than yours. So I think that a small bet on the river is probably your best option here. It does still give the villain room to raise as a bluff if he really wants to get crazy about it. I wouldn't so much count on that, but I think it gives him room to call with a lot of hands that are worse than a queen. And, you know, when you shove here, for the most part, either, you know, you win a pot that you were going to win anyway, or you chop a pot that you were going to chop anyway. I think that, you know, in order to make money, obviously you have to get called by hands worse than yours. And I think that because of how strong the villain's range is here generally, I think making a small bet is sort of is the best way to get those hands to put money in the pot.
Yeah, I agree. I think given that our plan was to bluff by betting big, right. I mean, of course, the nine is not the average card to come on the river, but I think the fact that that was our plan strongly suggests that a small bet is called for from an exploitive point of view.
Yeah. And to his credit, this is exactly what Claw did. He bet $4 into 1460, which I think is perfect sizing. And the button called him with ace 10 of clubs. So interesting play from the button's perspective in a number of ways, mostly with regard to the flop call. And this actually, I guess, makes me feel better about betting ace queen on the flop, that, you know, the villain called with ace 10, no draw. I mean, I guess he has a backdoor straight draw, but, you know, he just called here with nothing. And the reason I say it makes me feel better is that I really don't want him to start betting this hand if I check. I think there's a decent chance he ends up bluffing me out when that happens. And that's kind of a bad thing. So, you know, if he's willing to call with this on the flop, then our hand kind of functions as like a value bet, or it's just like it's another hand that's very likely, you know, either we dominate him, so there's a lot of ways in which he improves his hand a little bit and we improve our hand more, and that's good. And also, even though we're ahead, it's a hand that we do profit when he calls the flop and folds later. So the more that he's going to make loose calls like this on the flop, that actually improves our strategy, even though we're bluffing, and even though we have a better hand than he does, it's still kind of desirable for us to have these hands in his range that call now and fold later when our plan is to do multi-barrel bluffing. So the fact that he's going to be like extra loose on the flop kind of makes me like the flop bet more, actually.
I agree. That sounds good.
And I think his river call is bad, and is the reason why we made this $4 bet. Like, he probably doesn't call a shove with that hand. He's probably not betting that hand. If check two, he probably shouldn't be calling $4 with it, but he did, which is why you want to bet $4. So I would say a pretty well played hand, Claude. You know, we maybe argued a little bit with some minor points, especially sizing on the turn, but I think a well played hand and an interesting hand.
Yeah, and thank you for writing in. If you have a hand that you would like to hear us talk about, podcast@thinkingpoker.net. That is podcast@thinkingpoker.net.
Devotion of a Carmelite, the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you.